Hello, you're watching Global Investor on Business Day TV. I'm Stephen Gunyan. Nick Kunze from Bridge Stockbrokers joining me this evening to guide us through all the latest news on global markets. Later in the show, we'll be joined by Chris Potgieter to discuss Old Mutual's food and agri portfolio. All that coming your way shortly. First, though, a quick look at what's been making the headlines. Well, T-Mobile and Sprint have finally agreed on a merger. The $26 billion agreement ends 4 years of on and off talks between the US's third and fourth largest wireless carriers. The new firm will retain the T-Mobile name and be run by its current CEO, John Legere. Amazon's raised the price of its Prime membership for US subscribers by $20. The move is expected to add a windfall to the company's subscription revenue, which was up 60% in the first quarter at just over $3 billion. And world stocks appear to be set for a positive month for the first time since January. That has a slew of positive earnings from US technology firms and M&A deals helped soothe memories of February's tremors. Here's more on that.
It was a holiday in Japan, China and India, but Europe got off to a strong start, partly thanks to Asian events. Easing tensions in the Korean Peninsula, combined with some shining US first quarter earnings. The MSCI All Country Index of Global Equities was set for its first monthly rise since January.
We're afraid of three things: war, interest rates and tariffs. And now it's 2-1 for the markets. Firstly, North Korea's ruler wants peace. Secondly, the fear of interest rates has dissipated as yields are falling. Only concern over tariffs persists. And there is hope that the EU and the US can come to an agreement.
The EU was given a temporary reprieve from President Trump's steel and aluminium tariffs. It's hoping for a permanent one when the deadline expires on May the 1st. USA PLC is still keeping stocks up. More than half of Wall Street's S&P 500 companies have reported earnings, and almost four out of five of them have beaten consensus estimates.
It's on the back of the return to growth of the economy and also, of course, primarily the stabilization and tightening of the US employment market. So I think this is very largely one that's on USA PLC.
But 2017's dream run for equities, caused by easy monetary policies and synchronized world growth, is not expected to be repeated in 2018. Many expect the Fed to raise rates three more times, and US protectionism is still a concern, although a visit to China this week by US officials could be good news for the trade dispute.
Nick Kunze from Bridge Stockbrokers joining me in studio. So Nick, a very rough April, quite a volatile April, but it looks like a positive close today again. Is it going to be a case of sell in May and go away?
Stephen Greening, I think so. As you pointed out, it's been quite a volatile last couple of weeks. But U.S. earnings season is in full flow. They've been quite good. They were priced for absolute perfection, and we seem to be hitting those good results. And it appears that the earnings come out. The stock runs a little bit and then softens a bit, so maybe it is a case of going away.
But I mean, we are in for an extended period of volatility, it looks like. And last year there was complaints that we didn't have enough volatility in the market. This year we have seen, and we saw with the yield on 10-year treasuries going above 3% last week, the sort of knee-jerk reaction you had in the equity market. Is that likely to continue?
I think it is. I think certainly the theme for the moment is all about the yield curve. You know, where is it flattening? Is it steepening? What is it doing? Currently, this yield curve is actually flattening, which signifies normally a change in trends. So I think markets and market watchers are a little bit nervous that maybe this good run that we've had is possibly coming to an end.
Well, we've had some economic data out of the United States, and that's ahead of the US Fed meeting. I think it's tomorrow and Wednesday the Fed meets. We had first quarter GDP better than expected at 2.3%, though slowing down from the fourth quarter of last year. CPI 2% last month. What's the Fed going to make of all this?
Well, I think the Fed are looking at this and going, well, inflation is possibly coming back. You know, the Fed Reserve has been very adamant that they need inflation to kick in, and this is the reason why that the 10-year yield has been so low for so long. Apart from the last couple of weeks, there's been no inflation. But right now, what we're seeing is inflation kicking up. And also, you've got, don't forget, you've got oil prices kicking up as well. Mm-hmm. You know, oil back at over $70 a barrel. That is inflationary. And I think that if I was the Fed, I'd be quite welcome that there's a bit of inflation kicking in.
No expectation of a rate hike this week, though, but potentially at the next meeting?
No, exactly right. There's going to, the market watchers are saying no rate hike, but possibly next time. And possibly, you know, I think the markets are possibly a little complacent. They're talking about three rate hikes. It's possibly four. So, as I said, with inflation looking like it's kicking in, it might be more likely. Mm-hmm.
And then what did you make of the ECB's meeting last week? So they are also chasing inflation. Mm. It's not quite at the same point as the US yet, though.
And Draghi extremely dovish, as he always has been. I mean, constantly, we're not raising rates, we're not raising rates, we're not raising rates. You know, at some point, the market is looking for them to at least signal that maybe the ECB is going to exit their stimulus package. But for now, very, very dovish, and it continues to be, it could be that way.
Okay, let's take a look at some of the results that we've had out. And as you said, more than half of the S&P has reported mm-hmm. back, 4 out of 5 beating consensus so far. And we had all of the big tech companies out already, so Amazon, Twitter, Facebook. And Facebook, a positive surprise, but could be worse things to come following the Cambridge Analytica fallout.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, I mean, Facebook's been in certainly in the headlines for the wrong reasons, but it's still... It continues to be it's a money printing machine. I mean, the amount of money they make at advertising up 17-odd% that was year on year. It continues to be a really good investment theme, but there are concerns over how they're going to certainly control what's happening with the spotlight on them at the moment.
Would you be wary of Facebook in the meantime?
I'd be cautious, Stephen. I think at the moment, you know, it's 172 rand. You know, $172. It was back at 158, 160 a couple of days ago. But it's bounced back a little bit, but I'd continue to be a little bit cautious on the stock.
Okay. Amazon, they've lifted the veil on their Prime membership subscribers, 100 million of them, and it's now just announced that it's going to stick its prices up for Prime members in the United States by 20%, so to $119 from $99. And that, I mean, that's a great annuity stream for Amazon.
And quite extraordinary because, I mean, Amazon's been very, very, they don't like telling you what they're doing. If you lift up under the hood, they don't say much. But in this particular case, it was actually leaked on a memo that we went out to internal staff that they've got over 100 million Amazon Prime members. It continues to just be an extraordinary business and an annuity income business that really keeps them going.
Mm. Too expensive to invest in?
I mean, people are arguing that Amazon was too expensive, $700. I mean, it's now close to $1,600. So I think the naysayers continue to keep doing that.
Okay. We've also had some earnings coming out of Europe and lots of the big banks reporting back. We had Barclays, Royal Bank of Scotland over the last week. Deutsche Bank as well, and Deutsche Bank's 79% drop in first quarter profit, cutting back on its investment banking. It looks like Barclays is benefiting from that. Deutsche Bank, is it facing a breakup? How's it going to turn itself around?
I think Deutsche Bank is a quite a difficult thing to quantify. As a stock, it at one stage was one of the largest banks in the world, and now they... I think that there's a question mark over what do they want to be. I think they will continue to certainly to exit what they're doing in Europe, and that's not good. I mean, they continue to downsize themselves. They're getting smaller and smaller and smaller. And I just get the impression that Deutsche Bank is not going to be the player that they used to be.
Okay, and a couple of M&A deals going down, Sprint and T-Mobile, $26 billion merger, so that's the third and fourth largest wireless carriers in the United States, but it's been 4 years coming, yeah. Why now?
Yeah, long overdue. So I just think the environment is with cheap rates where they are, before we're heading into a high interest rate environment, it makes sense to certainly bed this down now, and they've been talking about it for ages. So it's long overdue. Finally, they got the Sprint Mobile deal happening.
I presume, since they have been talking about it for 4 years, that they have addressed any regulatory concerns that they might have anticipated. So, I mean, do you see any hurdles here?
No, I don't. I think the market wants it to happen. I think regulators are quite keen to certainly bed this down, and I don't foresee anything else happening.
Okay, and then Sainsbury buying Asda from Walmart, and that's a $10 billion deal, and it'll actually then overtake Tesco as the biggest supermarket group in the United Kingdom. But you're looking at two retailers at opposite ends of the spectrum, because Sainsbury very much upper middle market, and Asda very much lower end of the market.
Yeah, but I think, you know what, I think it's actually quite a nice fit. You know, Sainsbury's is trying to differentiate itself, and you know, the market doesn't quite know what it's to do. The market's looking for a deal. There's been rumours of us for a while, but I actually personally think it's quite a good fit. So let's see if they merge it. Let's see what happens. Look, early days yet, but I think overall, I think it's quite a good fit.
Any thoughts on Walmart exiting the UK, though?
No, I just think Walmart, it just, you know, they got their fingers burned. They tried a few different things in the UK with Brexit, with what's happening in the Eurozone. I don't think they're going to feel it.
And how about, I suppose they're also facing competition for some of those German retailers like Aldi and Lidl, and of course online retailers, so probably pays to have economies of scale and be lean and mean.
Lean and mean, exactly, and as I said, you know, once again, the Brexit is possibly, at the latest indications, is not looking like it's going to be a very smooth ending, and I think if I was a US retailer, I'd certainly be staying away.
Okay, let's leave it there for a moment. We're going to a short break. When we come back, we're going to take a look at Old Mutual's food and agri portfolio. That's with Chris Potgieter. Don't go anywhere. Welcome back. You're watching Global Investors. Still with me in studio, Nick Kunze from Bridge Stockbrokers, joining us on the line to discuss their food and agri portfolio. Chris Potgieter, the CEO of Old Mutual Wealth Trust Company. Chris, thanks very much for chatting to us. So tell us, in a nutshell, what are you getting if you invest in the global food and agri portfolio?
Stephen, if you invest in this portfolio, firstly, you must invest in the long-term theme of global food security. It's ultimately not a portfolio, you know, for short-term investing. It is a portfolio which does have cyclical elements to it, but also some stable elements. And in order to stomach the cyclicality, you have to be an investor for the long term and believe in the theme of global food security. So, you know, if you look at a number of investment themes, that we've identified for long-term investors, food security stands apart from many others as being a solid foundation for investing, as I said, for the long term.
And I suppose, I mean, you talk about long term, so 7 years plus, and the situation, I suppose, globally is only going to get worse with limited and shrinking resources on one hand and growing demand for food on the other hand.
Absolutely. So 7 years plus, definitely. We would actually recommend longer than that, 10 years or longer. When we look at both the demand and the supply side of food security in the world, demand is set to increase. There is no doubt about it. You know, we've got short memories, but in 1960, world population was 3 billion people. We're now 7 billion people. We are facing you know, growth in populations in developing countries that equal the U.S. population every 4 or 5 years. That's the growth in developing countries. You also have GDP per capita increasing. And if GDP per capita increases, you can expect, as it's already been seen, that caloric intake per person is going to increase. And that will put, you know, more demand on the production of protein. And protein, by its nature, is pretty intensive. You know, it takes 5 kilograms of crop to produce 1 kilogram of meat, for example. And the ratio tells you that demand, you know, for crop demand certainly will increase quite significantly. By our estimates, crop demand by 2050 will probably be 100% higher than where it is today. That's the demand side. And then when you look at the supply constraints, globally, you know, 20% of arable land is already degraded. You're not adding more land of the same quality than what is being lost, for example, through climate change or urbanization. The North American diet at the moment requires about 2 acres per person. If the current trends of land degradation and loss of land continues, then in 40 years' time, you'll have less than 20% of that available per person. Also, you know, fresh water is the other factor. 70% of fresh water, 60 to 70% of fresh water globally is consumed by agriculture in the production of food. So I think if you combine those demand, rising demand trends coupled to the supply constraints, you will see that over the long term, if you have a view of 10 years or longer, the global agri and food value chain presents significant investment opportunities.
Okay, before we get into the makeup of the fund, let me ask Nick, is this something that whets your appetite, Nick?
No, absolutely. I actually, it's a little bit of a pet project of mine. I love this whole the theme with where we're going with this, and I think it's brilliant. Just a thought. I mean, with current rumblings, with what's happening in our local market, with politics, etc., with talking about sort of land invasion. I mean, is this a concern going on? Do you think? Mm.
Your thoughts on that, Chris, in South Africa in particular, where you do have threats of land security?
Yeah, look, this portfolio is global in its nature, so there's no particular geography that will present, you know, significant risks to the portfolio. I also think, you know, not wanting to comment on any of the local developments in too much detail, but, you know, there's a way to work through these things. You know, the trade wars is another example of something that could be of significant concern that will also impact the food and agricultural value chain. But again, there will be those that benefit and there will be others that benefit less with these developments. But ultimately, you know, ultimately demand has to be met and supply will find, you know, new markets.
Okay. Tell us about the sort of companies that the fund invests in, because you go right across the value chain, so from the seed producers and, I suppose, fertilizer companies, all the way through to food producers and all down to retailers and wholesalers and even Starbucks.
Yes, so as I said, you know, the early part of the value chain tends to be very cyclical. If you look at the commodity producers themselves and then those directly impacted, you know, the seed, you know, the supplies of seed, pesticides, so forth, farming equipment like Deere & Company. So those do tend to be quite cyclical. And that's why we've constructed the portfolio with some elements towards the other parts of the value chain. So when you start looking at your logistics, your packaging, and your retailing, you will get more stability, more stable performance, you know, of companies and more stable performance of the portfolio in total. Company like Starbucks, for example, is very interesting because they have integrated upwards in the supply chain that feeds them, you know, and they've done it in a very ethical way to ensure that coffee is harvested in a sustainable way, that communities of small farmers are not exploited unduly and unduly treated in terms of price taking. And you know, that's why the company has found its way into the portfolio. Coffee is a very important beverage globally. You take a country, for example, like Japan, who, you know, in the 60s was still predominantly tea-consuming nation, and today consumes more coffee than tea. And you've got a population in China which is significantly larger than Japan, with a similar dynamic starting to happen, where coffee is only now being adopted as an alternative beverage to tea. So coffee makes sense as part of this portfolio. Starbucks makes specific sense because of its significant presence in both the production of coffee and the retailing of the coffee beverage.
Now, I noticed that you've used a sort of satellite approach with the fund. You have a couple of ETFs, which are the anchors. So the two biggest holdings are ETFs. You've got one which is called Moo and one which is called Veggie, interestingly enough. Why two ETFs? Because I see there is a bit of overlap between the two different ETFs that are the biggest holdings.
Yes, those ETFs do have some overlap, and they are two ETFs because effectively they do offer some differences in terms of which part of or how they classify companies for inclusion. I think the job an ETF does in a portfolio like this is it does give you exposure to certain geographies and sectors with significant diversification, which is impossible to attain on a direct holding basis. It also does produce for you some stability in the portfolio because of that very diversification that it offers. And we've decided to include two because, as I say, apart from the overlap, there are some differences which are meaningful in the way in which these ETFs are constructed and managed by the ETF providers.
Your thoughts on using a core of ETFs in a fund like this, Nick?
Yeah, I can see the merits behind it. My personal view is that certainly the structured space that Chris is getting into is it's not your typical portfolio, and I quite like it. I think it's heading into, we talk about food inflation. I mean, everyone's talking about inflation. Where's inflation coming? Well, you know what? And food inflation is coming around the corner. So a portfolio like this, I think, is very nicely structured.
Mm. And Chris, it's a fairly new fund, so there isn't a track record. Your benchmark is the MSCI Select Agri Producers Index. Have you measured how your performance would have related to that benchmark over the past?
Yeah, we've done some backtesting, Stephen, but we don't like to market any portfolio based on backtesting. So we would expect to outperform the index. The two ETFs will more closely track the index, obviously, but the tilts that we apply into the portfolio, the direct holdings, is intended to give us better opportunities relative to what one would find in the index over shorter periods of time. So even though I said that you want to invest for the longer term, our job here is to outperform that index after fees significantly over a rolling basis. And the tilts away from the ETFs and from the index are the direct holdings that you currently observe in the portfolio. So if I was to say past performance, obviously it's easy to reconstruct past performance, but we would certainly expect it to be in excess of the index by a significant margin, at least fees, but in fees plus some.
So what sort of returns could investors be looking at for a fund like this,
or for a portfolio like this?
Yeah, look, I mean, again, you know, one must be very careful in predicting returns, but, you know, long-term equity returns, you know, global equity returns in nominal terms, one could expect probably, given current PEs in the order of 10% per annum nominally. The agri sector in particular, agri and food sector in particular, presents an interesting valuation entry point at the moment because it has obviously not been as subject to as much valuation or price earnings expansion as some of the other more favored sectors, the obvious one being information technology. Back in 2006-07, when there was a global food shortage, I think, again, we tend to forget about this, but it was only 10 years ago when we faced a global food shortage, and that was compounded by the production of ethanol from corn and sugar because of energy prices, oil prices being so high. At that stage, you know, PEs accelerated quite significantly, and the sector, in fact, for a period of time, outperformed most other sectors. But I would say that it's probably reasonable to expect in the order of 10% nominal over the longer term.
Well, of course, this is, of course, for investors with deep pockets, isn't it? Because it's a minimum investment of $75,000, Chris.
Yes, so $75,000 for a global portfolio that is diversified to the extent that this one is, that is not only constructed out of ETFs but have direct holdings, in our view is a very low number. It may be a high number for the average investor, and maybe then for, you know, those that do not have, you know, $75,000 to invest in such a portfolio, it may be sensible to construct a derivative of this portfolio comprising of the two ETFs and perhaps, you know, one or two other ETFs, which we may be able to suggest.
Chris, we have to leave it there. Thanks very much for sharing it with us this evening.
Pleasure. Thank you.
And thanks again to you, Nick, as well. I think I'm one of the average investors, so I don't think I'll be buying it just yet, but maybe in the future.
25,000, yeah. We'll leave it at that.
Yeah, that's the show for this week. Thanks again to Nick Kunze from Bridge Stockbrokers, Chris Potgieter, the CEO of Old Mutual Wealth Trust Company, for their insights. Thanks to you for watching. Same time next week. Goodbye.